The first time I came into Sonnet, I was still driving my small KBS. It was a KBS Toyota IST.
Right.
Tiny. And colleagues senators were like, Asige, you're going to have to upgrade. I live way below my means. Way, way, way. I think my monthly sort of expenditure is, including rent,
yeah,
it's like 50K.
Wow. Welcome back to Financially Incorrect. I am your host, Barack. Remember, this is a place where we have a cheeky take on serious financial topics. This month has been an Autism Awareness Month, the month of April. So I will keep talking about it. I'll keep mentioning it. So, of course, I talked about it in Jeff's episode. I'm personally affected. Well, or rather, live. I have a nephew who's autistic, and I've had to look at my brother sort of changing his life a little bit just to make sure that he's able to give him the best care. So I just keep saying for this month, anybody who is taking care of anybody with autism, anyone who's a caregiver or a parent, shout out to you. And if you know anyone, please do give them a hug, give them support, buy them coffee. It's not easy. So that's it for Autism Awareness Month. Remember, this podcast is proudly sponsored by FX Spesa. And remember, if you'd like to open a demo account or a live account, you can check out the links in the description box. If you'd like to learn more physically, or be educated physically on the trading, online trading, you can go to any of their locations in Nakuru, Eldoret, Thika, Kitengela, or in Kampala if you're in Uganda. And FX Pesa are the beautiful people who allow us to be able to have Financially Incorrect. So please do check them out. Today, I have a very, very special guest with me. She wears many hats, as I was told, very, very many hats. But I'm going to introduce her as a nominated senator, Crystal Asige. Welcome to Financially Incorrect.
Thank you so much.
Yeah.
And I didn't know that you had such a close relationship to autism.
Yes, 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 I do, actually. Do you know anyone who's autistic?
Many people. Yeah.
Oh, yeah?
By virtue of being in the disabled community being a leader in, not in my immediate family.
Yeah.
Yeah. Should I tell you an interesting juncture between finance and autism?
Please do.
Apparently,
yeah,
according to my research and all of the work I've done in disability in general,
right,
men who have very technical careers like finance, engineering, accounting, mm-hmm, things that are very analytical in nature,
yeah,
are more prone to be fathers of an autistic child.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
That's very interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
And also, Silicon Valley in California,
yeah,
has 10 times more prevalency of people on the autism spectrum than any other part of the states because yeah, of the nature of work that's there.
Yeah.
Innovation, math, tech, very analytical.
Yeah.
Very,
What's the correlation between the analytical element and birthing or, siring an autistic?
That's the part that's interesting.
Yeah.
I think you would need to have a doctor here to explain it better.
Yeah.
But it's something about the genome that belongs to a person who is very analytical in thinking,
right,
and spends years and decades in that kind of field or sector.
Right.
In their genome, there is something that they pass along to their children.
Yeah.
And boys are 4 times more likely to be autistic than girls.
I also did not know that.
I'm just out here.
Yeah. I also did not know that. I mean, yeah, so I have my nephew. He was diagnosed at, I believe he was 2,
mm-hmm,
so relatively young. Initially nonverbal, but now he's talking a lot more.
Right.
He's expressing himself a lot better. He can be in, initially he struggled being in loud, environments,
yeah,
and around a lot of people.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
these days, I mean, he's at the family functions, he's at the trips. He loves swimming. Very smart, very sharp,
yep,
very, very sharp. I mean, he'll play with the numbers and the letters and everything in school, very sharp, very cool. So I guess we're trying to do everything that we can to try and ensure that he has the best possible life that he can, of course.
Yeah. And it's good,
yeah,
that it's really good that you guys had the opportunity to find it or diagnose it early.
Yeah.
Because early,
yeah,
intervention really is the key to how,
yeah,
that child will then grow up and be able to function with their disability.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So 2 years old is actually 0 to 2 is
best
the time they
to,
say,
yeah,
yeah, to make sure that you get tested if you see the signs of, your child,
yeah,
maybe displaying these types of traits.
Yeah,
it's best to get as get it as early as possible.
But it's definitely not easy. I mean, I watch my twin brother when my nephew has an episode,
mm-hmm.
and it's it's like I feel for him, and there's nothing you can do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's a little tough. But anyway, that's it. So yes, if you know someone who's dealing with autism, just give them a shout out. So let's get into our episode for today. Right, we're gonna find out about your money journey. Find out how you got to be a senator and what you're doing with all your money.
Yeah.
So let's start with, I guess, I know you've talked about this, so I don't want to like belabor the point about you living in Mombasa and growing up, but what was it like and what was the money environment that you grew up in?
So I'm the last born in my family.
Yeah.
And my family was definitely amongst those who feel or who imparted to us as kids that money is scarce.
Yeah.
Like when we used to go to Uchumi, when Uchumi was, you know, the supermarket that was open, aging me a bit. But when we used to go to Uchumi, my mom would always say, think about it. Do you really, really need this? Yeah. Even if I was just getting a pack of crisps just a sweet, do you really, really need this? Because, you know, money is tight. So I always grew up with that mentality of, like, the scarcity mentality.
Yeah.
And when I get money, I need to really, like, keep it, harbor it, take care of it, throw it under the pillow, under the bed, under the mattress. And that was my first socialization with money. Mm-hmm. And then I grew up, I mean, still the same sort of foundations around money.
Mm-hmm.
In school, I used to do anything to make sure that I save every penny, going around picking up empty soda bottles so I can go to the shop and get the deposit for it, the 10 bob deposit.
Right.
Even returning plates from the canteen, you'd get 5 shillings. And mm-hmm. I used to be like, okay, if everyone else is too lazy, I'll take them back for you, sort of thing, so that I can save all those monies and go home and put them in my little kitty.
Yeah.
So I think... I mean, pros and cons with that, because of course you get scared as an adult to make investments, to spend money. You're always second guessing yourself. Am I doing the right thing? Am I making the right choice with my money? On the flip side, though, it does help in saving.
Yeah.
It does help you to not splurge, to not overspend. And those were sort of like my first lessons in money.
So was it that money doesn't grow on trees comment that, you know, sort of?
Yeah, that was the sentiment completely. We know they don't grow on trees, but
okay. So you grew up in Mombasa, and you mentioned to me that you started in a Kenyan system school and then shift over to the British system school. I mean, there must have been a fee implication to that shift as well, right? Because the British system schools tend to be a bit more expensive.
Yeah, much.
So, was your family rather comfortable then, you know?
So in my family, my dad's a lawyer. My grandfather, the late Adembesa, was also a lawyer. And mm-hmm. my brother is now, as an adult, a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
But at the time, they didn't really, I was kind of shielded from that. Mm-hmm. My parents never really used to let us know that they were struggling with monies. Of course, my dad was one of the very first lawyers who was doing well in Mombasa. It was a very mm-hmm. tiny island.
Mm-hmm.
So he was doing, you know, well, whatever well was back in, you know, the 90s and the 80s before he started his family. So we never really were made aware of, okay, we are struggling with this. Whatever we needed, he would usually, you know, get it. He wouldn't say, oh, no. But it's just that small things. And my mom was, like I said, takes us here, takes us there. Right. She was always reminding us, like, hey, dad is struggling, but he would never show us that he's struggling.
Mm,
So when we went into the British system school, like I said, we never really knew that there was an issue or that there was a struggle. However, I started to realize that, you know, as you continue growing up and maybe some trips were not affordable to me, some sports activities are not affordable for me, things like that. That's when you sort of, okay, so I get it. But overall, we had what we needed.
Okay. Mm. All right. So... how then does the trajectory to, you know, I mean, of course, by the time it's putting in the British system school, the trajectory is to go to the UK.
Yes.
But that's not a cheap endeavor either,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, mm-hmm. so I hear, you know, you saying that, yeah, you know, going for certain trips locally, but, you know, you're heading out to Bristol to get your undergrad done. How did you guys, or as far as you're aware, how did you guys foot that bill?
Help from friends, Harambe. I think Harambees are
right.
a cornerstone of Kenyan culture, African culture, I guess.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
He definitely got help from friends.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, he would not make that known to us,
mm-hmm.
but he did have help from friends, and he was taking loans, and he was doing installment plans at school, university. There were some times in university where I was late to pay my fees,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I was being sent letters and being told, hey, it's your 3 months overdue type of thing. But I would, you know, just work and maneuver my way in the HR offices and the finance offices. But they did absolutely everything they could to put me through that education, because
yeah.
I guess they were thinking of ROI.
Right, right.
Yeah.
At the end of the day,
mm-hmm.
yeah, what are you going to get? Right. Okay. And at the end in the UK, did you feel like you had to work? To be able to...
Yes, brother.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I had 3 jobs in the UK whilst
right.
I was studying.
Yeah.
So that I could not... So I didn't need to rely on my dad or my
mm-hmm.
parents to send me pocket money as well as, you know, paying for my school fees. So I was like, okay. I looked at that fee note, like £9,000 it used to be at the time.
Yeah.
While local students in the UK were paying
£1,500 yeah.
or £2,000.
Yeah.
So mine was over 2 or 3 times more expensive.
I think now it's like 16,000, I think.
Correct.
Yeah.
And that depends on the discipline that you're taking.
Yeah.
Medicine
yeah.
is even crazier.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I had to get 3 jobs. I was a tutor first for maths, English, science
mm-hmm.
to kids who are in the black and minority ethnic groups.
Mm-hmm.
So kids who came over with their parents who are nurses or doctors and
mm-hmm.
they, you know, migrated from Africa or
mm-hmm.
Asia. So I was a tutor to those kids after school activity. And then I was also a bartender
mm-hmm.
/ waitress.
Mm-hmm.
And then I was working in an events company as well. Those were my 3 jobs. And I would, you know, maneuver.
Were you exceeding the 20 hours? Or those days you didn't have the limit of 20 hours a week as a student?
There were
student.
Limits, but who am I? Who are we?
Right, right. Okay.
So, yeah, I had to because I needed to pay my rent. I needed to go to Tesco's and whatever else
yeah.
to buy food. There was times
yeah.
I had so little money,
mm-hmm.
I would only go to the supermarket and buy cornflakes, like the supermarket brand. Not
yeah,
like,
right,
not
right.
Kellogg's.
Not brand.
Not
like
the main,
off-brand
correct.
Cereal, right.
Cornflakes and tea bags. And I used to, in the evenings, drink black tea and
yeah.
dry cornflakes. That's how broke I used to be sometimes.
So even with the cornflakes, like no milk? Just like
couldn't
dry cornflakes and black tea?
And black tea.
So
because the 2 didn't expire for a very long time.
Right.
So. and tap water is free
right.
in the UK. So.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm.
So did your folks just pay the tuition and you were then, I'm going to figure life out?
Yes, half and half. They would support me when I needed, you know, a top up.
Yeah.
But I would definitely be focusing on like my own... income
yeah.
outside of what they were sending me.
Right.
Yeah.
And you said you're there for 8 years, right?
Yeah, about.
How many times do you come back?
The first time I came back when I first went in 2007, and it took me like a year and a half to come back the first time. Because
mm-hmm.
Crazy flights, you
right,
know?
Right,
so
prices,
expensive.
Yeah.
So I remember spending my first winter in dorms on my own. And then a friend who was on my course, she's Welsh, she came back to because she forgot something or they were coming back to pick something up from her dorm, which is next to ours.
Mm-hmm.
And then she found my lights on, me only the only person in the 6-bedroom dorm.
Right.
Hey, Crystal, why are you still here? I can't
yeah.
imitate her Welsh
yeah,
accent,
right.
but why are you still here? I said, oh, I couldn't go home for Christmas. She's like, oh my God, come with us. We'll take you to Wales for our Christmas. You can't
right.
stay alone.
Yeah.
And I think that she, for the first time, when interacting with me, a Kenyan, an African, whatever, seeing that how lonely it can actually be
yeah.
to be an
yeah.
international student.
Yeah.
From then on, we were like besties and she always took care of me as well as her parents.
Yeah.
Mm.
I mean, but that must have been, I mean, did it feel, I mean, not just lonely, but I would assume from a financial perspective, if you're working 3 jobs, I mean, you know that money is tight.
Yeah.
It seems like you don't really have like a one-way ticket back home.
Correct.
That must have been quite challenging to say the least.
Yeah, challenging. And I hid it a lot from my peers, my classmates.
So even with her, you just told her I couldn't go home. You didn't tell her why you couldn't
no,
go
I
home.
No, I didn't tell her why. I just said that I wasn't able to
yeah.
go home for Christmas and made excuses, na-na-na, tried to brush over it. And she was like, no, you have to be with someone for Christmas, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I would never let it be known to any of my classmates or anything like that on my course, in my dorm. that I was struggling with money because I didn't want, and I mean, I was already black. I was already a girl.
Yeah.
Straight from Kenya, not even like living in Europe in my childhood. And I had a disability that was gradually sort of like really affecting my life, impacting my life every day, because it was a gradual decline.
Right.
And so I was like, I'm not going to add another intersectionality by telling them that I can't afford this, I can't afford that, can't afford to go to this party, can't afford the dress, you know, fancy dress costumes that, you know, Europeans really love doing fancy dress parties for Halloween and da-da-da. Can't do it, man. So,
I mean, I want to ask you though, but how long do you think it takes for, I guess, your group of friends to know that though? Because I'm assuming, I mean, even if you're eating, I mean, were you eating your cornflakes and black tea like in the middle of the night when no one else, like no one else is awake, and you're like, said, nobody is going to know that I have a financial issue. And then I'm also wondering, I mean, if you're there for a considerable period in time, I mean, it's only a matter of time. You know, we all have these friends who, you know, the person's not coming out, or we do go out and they're only having a soda and not having a meal. It takes a while and you realize, okay, maybe like there's something, you know, underneath that's going on. I may not ask about it, but I'll have an idea. So do you also think genuinely they did not know that you had a money problem?
Genuinely, I think they didn't know. I'm very good at masking. I think we all are as human beings, especially when we have something that we feel really protective over and vulnerable around, we really want to mask it.
Yeah.
So no, they didn't know. And half of it was maybe because, you know, everyone is young. Everyone's just living their own life, you know, we're at uni, YOLO kind of thing.
Yeah.
No one has time to sit down and be like, so, Barack, what's happening in your life, you know? Yeah. So that was part of it. And also, like I said, it was half me and my sort of not wanting to be forthcoming.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I also find, I don't know if anyone else listening have found the same, but I had more trouble or didn't get much acceptance from my own Kenyan community who are out there in Bristol.
Mm-hmm.
I found it more difficult to latch onto or to group with fellow Kenyans because
mm-hmm.
I felt like they were more judgmental. So in my money struggles at uni, I was like, I'm not going to go to that Kenyan party. I'm not going to go to that Kenyan barbecue.
Yeah.
Okay,
that's interesting.
Yeah, they're less judgmental.
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe in the comments, people will tell us, I get what, you know, what their experience is like and if they found out to be the same. I want to ask a question, because you've talked about a little bit, I guess, touched on it a little bit on the glaucoma. I want to ask, from the date you get there, when you're now in the UK, when they're giving you the predictive diagnosis of when they think that you'd eventually lose your vision, do you get any monetary, do you have a monetary thinking line of saying, okay, I have X years to go, I need to be able to make it financially in my life, I can use my vision for the next X years to X amount, and that would be able to help me at least, you know, in one way or another. Did you have any sort of thought like that?
Actually, no. I wish I did. My goodness. Where were you, Barack, back in the day? to be my advisor? No, I didn't, because I was working. So that means I was paying taxes.
Okay.
I was on their version of KRA. Mm-hmm. And so that meant that you were able to access NHS. And that was free if you were working and you're paying your taxes, etc. So I was covered by NHS whilst I was there with my visa and all that. And then also that included medication. If you have you have your prescription paper, you go to any chemist and you show your card, your blah, blah. It's called the NI card, National Insurance card. And then they, of course, just give it to you over the counter.
Yeah.
And so there were no financial sort of strains in that way.
Right.
And because even though they had predicted that I was going to be blind by around 25, I wasn't sitting and sort of like calculating the nuts and bolts of disability. I was still caught up in the emotions.
Okay.
I was still caught up in like the spiritual and the, you know, the soul part of it, right?
Yeah.
Rather than thinking, okay, I need to get this together.
Yeah.
You know, da-da-da-da. It wasn't really on my mind. And also because I was that young and I was not with my parents. The parents and most of my family was back in Kenya, Mombasa. So it wasn't like there was anyone saying, okay, Crystal, let's pack away the tears. And let's now start planning for your next 5 years, your next 10 years. It wasn't like that, no.
How long do you would you say that it took you to get through the emotional, like, soul battle that you're talking about? I mean, how long did you cry for? Was it months? Was it years? Was it...
Yo.
And is it on and off? And or is it like a heartbreak when you hear a specific song and mm-hmm. you're like, oh my goodness? Mm-hmm. Or is it like trying to take in everything that you could see at the time? Yeah.
It was everything. Now I'm even getting emotional thinking about it.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But losing a disability in the middle of your life, I mean, losing an ability, in the middle of your life, it's like experiencing death of a loved one, right? This is something that, when you think about it, this is something that I wake up with all the time. Since I was born, I wake up and I'm with it. It guides me throughout my life, throughout my days. It gives me opportunity to go here, experience that. It's something that is with me, similar to like a loved one, similar to like a parent, a spouse, a child that you're always with and you feel completely at, like, you know, one with, unified with.
Yeah.
And experiencing a time where someone says, you're going to lose that thing, eventually, soon you'll lose it. So be prepared.
Yeah.
You can't prepare to lose your mom. You can't be prepared to lose your daughter, you know, your spouse.
It's
nothing that you can do to really prepare. And so... it's an on and off. Even till today, there are still moments where I feel, oh, man, if I had this, I could have been here. I could have been able to do that.
Right.
I could see what I look like now at this age.
Right.
I could see my nephew, you know, things like this.
Yeah.
So it's a constant for sure. But then I am able to catch it quicker now with a bit more awareness and a bit more, you know, work, internal work and things. Therapy. And so it's not as... You know, before I used to sit on a bus and just be like bawling, like, for no reason. And the person sitting next to me is like, oh, she wanted a tissue. Awkward for everyone around me.
Yeah.
But now I am able to at least, you know, contain. Like, I wait till I get home and then I cry.
And then, okay, I see. So, I mean, as you're, you know, get your diagnosis, you're battling it. So how long does it take you to begin to have rational thought around what your life potentially could look like moving forward?
So in the UK, they have rehabilitation services. And so when I was given the diagnosis and I was told, okay, this is inevitable, it will happen, they then gave me the opportunity to sign up to different classes, to go for different types of trainings. It's called ONM, Orientation and Mobility, it's called, so that I can start learning, okay, I'm about to go blind. How do I now cook? How do I read different coins, identify different notes? How do I cross the street safely? You know, different tips and tricks and hacks on how to then live with your disability once, you know, you're fully in it. So I was able to get that kind of support before I lost all of my eyesight or most of it anyway.
Yeah.
So it made it a little bit easier.
Yeah. So, and at this point as well, is it like, do you have group counseling sessions where you're also hearing other people talk about them? The experiences.
I evaded them, imagine. In true Kenyan style. Like,
we don't do this thing on your own.
Yay, counseling, therapy. That's not for me. That's what I used to think.
Wow, okay.
Yeah, unhealthy thing.
I don't know if that's like brave or... I mean, looking back now, do you think that was the right decision?
Was it the right decision? I don't know. I probably could have indulged in and gone for those...
A session or two,
just to get some initial support. And the reason why I didn't go is because I was like, you guys don't know my God. You know, you people in England, you serve different masters. But me, my God, tomorrow morning, I'm going to have my eyesight back.
Right.
Next Saturday,
right,
I'll have it back, you know? So I used to wake up with that much belief, that much faith. And I thought that going for these counseling sessions would mean me giving up on myself and giving up on
your
God.
Faith.
Yeah, yeah.
And every week, as every Saturday is coming by and the vision's not coming back, I mean, are you losing faith in God?
No, I'm not. I'm still like...
You're still waiting for the miracle.
I'm still waiting. Waited and waited and being long-suffering. You know, it says in the Bible. You know, all these things that, you know, we're taught in our different religions. So I was not letting up. I was like, no, God. It's only when I came back from the UK... there was a time I was at home in Mombasa. Eyesight had declined, you know, tremendously. Maybe like 80% of it was gone by that time. And I was sat at home. I had no prospects. I was like, okay, what do I do when I'm back at home? No one's really hiring me. Don't really know what to do. I studied a degree that is very visual, you know, mm-hmm. film and theater.
Mm-hmm.
What now, God? And I was crying in bed, and it was rainy season. It was like May, that's sort of like May, June, July season,
mm-hmm.
rainy season. And the more I cried, the more it rained. Like the harder I cried, I felt the more it was raining outside. Mm-hmm. And so I went to bed that night, and then I was like, I mean, I remember this very vivid dream whereby there was a big light in front of me and I was sat opposite it and it was holding my cheeks and it said, be still. So I woke up in the morning and I went to my mom and said, what does this mean, be still? What do you think it means? And we flipped through the Bible and it said, Psalms 46:10, be still and know that I am God.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, cool. I've been waiting on you, God, though.
Yeah.
I've been waiting. Like, what do you mean, be still? Yeah. I've been still.
Yeah.
But then from there, I pivoted my thinking. Mm-hmm. I decided that if I can't change my circumstance, I'll change the way I think about it.
Okay.
And I was like, okay, so what can I do? What can I learn? What exactly do you want me to do with this disability?
Okay. I've watched the video where you talk about the Be Still Gem. And I think, in the video, the way they edited it, there's actually like a really cool white light that they use on it. So it's a really cool edit. I guess I want to ask a little bit about any financial implications when you come back from the UK and now you're not on NHS anymore.
Correct,
the medication's not free
or
any medical anything regarding medical service that you require isn't free. So what's that process like when you come back to Kenya? Like you're saying, nobody's hiring you at that particular point in time. So what are you thinking in terms of how you're gonna make money mm-hmm. and how you're gonna live?
So I wasn't on NHIF, until very recently, actually.
Yeah.
Maybe like 5 years ago is when I came on to NHIF. So when I came back, I was not on NHIF.
Okay.
Like you said, everything was being paid out of pocket.
Yeah.
It made, the consequence of that was that I was going for less checkups
because mm-hmm.
I couldn't afford it. My parents mm-hmm. couldn't really afford it either. It was mm-hmm. very expensive. Eye health is extremely expensive.
How much would a checkup cost?
A consultation would be like 5,000 shillings, mm-hmm. and then they would give you, because glaucoma requires you to have eye drops per month, mm-hmm. and eye drops expire after 30 days, so mm-hmm. you have to renew, mm-hmm. You have to get new drops all the time, and I was on 3 drops. So in a month, I would be spending, including consultation, maybe like 11 or 12,000 mm-hmm. anytime I was going for a checkup.
Yeah.
I knew that I would need to leave there with about 12,000 shillings at that hospital.
Yeah.
So I was going for less checkups, which of course was not a good idea.
Yeah.
But financially couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
And then they would tell me, oh, we could try this procedure, that procedure. I was like, no, I can't afford it. Can't afford it. So maybe there were moments that they could have intervened and done something, not to reverse it, but maybe slow it down, maybe to stop it, reduce the pressure perhaps. But because of finances, it was much more difficult. But being on insurance now as a senator, I could go anytime. I'm just like, ooh, Willie, hey, doc, what's up?
Go get a checkup. Yeah.
But at the time, it was not the same. So that's the impact I had. And then for money, I was teaching voice lessons.
Okay.
In Mombasa, like school kids. I used to, what was that website called? OLX.
Yes. What's now transitioned to, is it Gigi? Yeah.
So I posted a little ad there that I'm a vocal coach, et cetera. I did a profile. People would call me and come over to my house. We used to go to the roof of my parents' house.
Yeah.
Climb up the stairs, go to the roof, and then I would teach vocal classes there.
Yeah.
Another thing I used to do was make hummus.
Yes.
Put it in a jar, sell it.
Yeah.
My first clients, of course, were my siblings and my parents. But that was another way that I was making just like little small monies here and there.
Yeah.
And then once I started doing my blind girl manenos,
mm-hmm.
I was peanuts though.
Off
of online. Peanuts. Because I didn't really.
How much are peanuts?
Peanuts are like 150, 200, 500.
Is that
like
thousand or shillings?
No, shillings.
Okay.
thousand.
No, I'm like, you never know what people's perceptions peanuts. Or context are. Yeah, someone's peanuts, maybe someone else's.
Yeah, so
all right.
Those were some of the small ways I was saving.
Okay. I have an interesting question for you. Do you think that your parents' perceptions, your parents' expectations of you changed after your diagnosis, especially when it started getting very aggressive? Do you feel like their expectations of you in terms of being a, you know how society perceives a functioning adult of, you have your own house, pay your own bills. Yeah. Do you feel like their perceptions changed for you?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think they were definite, their grip loosened.
Yeah.
In terms of, okay, you're now 18, you're now 20, you're now 22, you know, what are you doing with your life? Definitely, I didn't have those types of conversations as much as maybe my other siblings might have had.
Mm-hmm.
They were supportive in what I wanted to do if I, because, I mean, disability is hard, yo.
It's
not, there's no way that you can really advise someone the best way to do it, you know, the best way to sort of maneuver through it. So, and they didn't know either. Nobody in my family has a disability, so there's no experience there. So what they just did was give me space, supported me, believed in me, whatever it is I wanted to do, whether I wanted to now become an event, like a small events planner for the local Sunday school at my church. Yes. What do you need from us? What do you want us to do? We want us to buy you serviettes, paper cups, what else? You know, they were very supportive in that way.
Yeah.
Because I guess they knew that I have no other choice at the moment, no other avenue to really pursue, because not just of going through disability, but also how society perceives disability.
Yeah.
It's not like they're very open.
Yeah.
I tried to get into media when I came back with my BBC experience on my CV. I was like, Mazze, like, you guys, you all know what's coming.
Yeah, yeah.
Guys,
did that
like,
not count for much?
No. Because my CV...
Yeah. Do you think now, if you were coming back now, do you think it would have, you would have been able to make that transition now as opposed to a couple of years ago?
Probably, with what I have, with what I know now.
Yeah, with what you know
and
now.
And how I handle myself now
and
the hacks that I use to get by my ES, it would have been easier. And I have more confidence now as well in myself, in my skin, in my disability. So at the time, though, they were like, we're not too sure. Like, so I was like, I decided to use my film and theater degree, put it into use, and now start the vlogs and start maybe working with in the NGO CSO like space.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So I mean, I'm curious. Did you feel? What's the word? Or looking back, what do you think would have been the best way to motivate you or to get you to get to where you are now? Do you feel like the journey that you took was long enough, or could it have been shortened in any way? I mean, to the point where now, yes, like you're nominated state senator, you're working with multiple NGOs.
Yeah.
Do you feel like that journey could have been made shorter by different things that people could have done for you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think representation, seeing someone that is in your situation doing fantastic things would have helped. Because when I looked on TV, I didn't see anchors with disabilities. I didn't see actors with disabilities. I didn't see business people with disabilities. You know, I didn't see leaders with disabilities. And so it wasn't something that I thought, oh, okay, life is going to be okay because I have this blueprint. I can look at so-and-so's life and sort of like follow and sort of be they can be a mentor for me type of thing, you know. So there was none of that at all. I didn't see anybody like me or anybody sort of like treading this path. Of being young, black, and, you know, into the arts, having a visual disability. You know, they say, or rather reports show, that people are more afraid of going blind than they are of death.
Yeah.
You know, you've heard, I'm sure you've heard people say, like, oh my gosh, I'd rather die than...
I mean...
be blind, things like that.
Yeah.
So it was very difficult. And at some point, I did rather, you know, die as well. But I think if I was able to see more people... if I had a Whoopi Goldberg in Kenya, who, she has glaucoma as well.
Yeah.
If I had a Bono, who's from U2, he has glaucoma.
Yeah.
If I had a Judi Dench from the Bond movies in Kenya, she has glaucoma. If they were local, on TV, on radio, in the community, I'd be like, oh my God, it's possible.
Yeah. Mm. Okay, fair enough. So what is it like the day that you wake up and like, sorry, what's it like the day that you wake up and you're now completely, completely blind? You cannot see at all. You've lost your vision completely. And a question on that, and not out of insensitivity, but curiosity, do you think it would have been easier to just go straight to that point? Or was the slow depreciation of your vision a better sort of, you know, journey sort of to take?
Right. I think for me, it was probably better that way.
Yeah.
Because at least I have memories. Mm-hmm. I have reference points. I have things that I can smile about even when I'm sitting amongst many people and I feel alone because it's dark in my eyes, I can still sort of like, oh, remember and think of this and think of that. So it does still give me joy in that way. But at least I had half of my life with vision and now without.
Yeah.
So there's that. And the time, there wasn't, I can't really remember a time where I couldn't see. It was, like I said, like you say, it's very gradual.
Yeah.
So, but what does it feel like to wake up and open your eyes and still see, think that it's dark?
Yeah.
I don't really think about it that much nowadays.
Yeah.
I just get on with shit.
Yeah.
It, sorry. Pardon me.
Yeah.
I just get on with it.
Yeah.
Nowadays, I don't sit and think, oh, I can't see, or oh, only when I drop something and I have to get on my hands and knees to find the coin, the earring. That's when I'm like, man, this disability, Moses.
Yeah.
You're taking me 5 extra minutes to get ready in the morning because I can't see.
Yeah.
But other than that, if I don't encounter a barrier, I don't remember my disability.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay. So in your money journey, we were at the place where you are now offering music classes. You are...
Yes, making hummus.
Making hummus and selling that.
Yeah.
When's the next big thing that happens in your money journey from there?
I get a gig with... Gosh, I don't know if I should tell this story. But I get a gig with a British NGO because they have a project in Mombasa that they're doing. And it's like a 1 year or is it 1.5 year project. And they want someone to sort of like document the project.
Yeah.
So who am I?
Yeah.
I'm like, yes, I'll apply. Applied, got it. Because
at this point in time, how much of a vision do you have
at this
left?
Point?
If you had to give us like a percentage, whatever that would mean.
Maybe about 20.
Okay.
Yeah, 20% of my vision. So can't see far. Night vision is completely short.
Yeah.
Very blurry. But with enough light, like daytime and then with lamp, if I'm studying on a table with a lamp, I can, you know, bring something close to my face and sort of make it out.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still, and also I'm not using a white cane full time by then.
Okay.
Okay, so that was the scene. So I apply, I get it. I guess they see BBC, they see I was studying in the UK. They're British as well, so there's a connect there. Hiya. Now we go to the field. And then I'm actually required to do the work.
Yeah.
Wow. Masking now. Uh-huh. Anyway, so I'm there with my camera because, you know, the anatomy of film is in
my
head.
Do you not have someone helping you?
Bro, let me tell you the story. So... I'm there with my camera because I know the technical, all the info is, education is in my mind.
Yeah.
But now the execution is the part that I'm struggling with.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting, you know, it's like a workshop type thing. The first thing is like they bring stakeholders into a workshop. You know, they're teaching them, training them on waste management. That's what it was about. I'm in the corner, tripod, setup, camera, you know, sort of like what's happening in here. I am pretending to film. I don't know what I'm going to do next, but my first plan was just hit, press the button and pretend and just do the thing, you know, touch.
So you're just like moving the camera around.
Yeah, correct. You know, now change my position, change my angle, getting these people on this side of the room, then that side, then the presenter, higher. When I get home, Crystal, you don't have footage. I mean, you have footage, but it's just random. It's not focused.
Yeah.
It's not, you've not set your shot, blah, blah, blah. I get home, I call a guy. You know, you have to have a guy.
Yeah.
I call, like, I'm like, yo, his name was Kip. Yo, Kip, I say, I'm going to pay you X amount of money to come and shadow and do this work, you know?
Yeah.
My name will be at the front, but you're the one who's done the work.
Yeah.
So the next day, day two of the thing, I bring Kip. And I'm like, yeah, this is,
assistant
this is my assistant.
Whatever,
yeah. So, because I realized on day one that, you know, lots of people, you know, it's better to have two cameras, da, da, da. So I'm still pretending on one camera, but Kip is actually doing the work on his camera.
Wow.
Then he edits at home. We sit in my place. I make sure that he's watered and fed for however many hours we need to edit. He edits it. I present it. I give my invoice. Crisis averted.
Wow. That is some serious balls. I don't, the way that I'm wired, I don't think I could do something like that.
Because I told them, listen, if I want to do this work, I mean, I'm not a 9-to-5. I can't be in this office. I need to be at home, in my environment. You know,
right,
I'm creative.
Right.
Did all that.
Okay.
Pulled all that.
Did they like the
work the end product. They loved it. Yeah. Okay. They loved the end product, yeah. But so I did not do that again.
Yeah.
It was way too stressful.
Yeah.
Way too stressful.
Just to try and figure out like, so moving forward, then what do you do, you know, in terms of your career and like looking for work and making money work for you, so to speak?
So I decide to, of course, well, not decide, I don't know if it's by choice,
yeah,
or just because of rejection. I'm in the entrepreneurial space. Mm-hmm. I'm like, okay, I'm just doing this on my own.
Yeah.
I used to save money, go on the night bus to Nairobi, and then look for different gigs, places at Carnival, at, what was that place called on Cheromo Road? I forgot. It's Galileo Lounge. Mm-hmm. I don't know where. Anywhere that there is music or art and culture, so that I could hopefully bump into to people who are of the same mind. And did that back and forth for quite a long time. I was able to meet, you know, the Eric Wainainas, Victor Say and all.
Right.
Just bumping into. But nothing was really sticking. And then I decided to go on LinkedIn for the first time. I was like, okay, what's this LinkedIn thing? Let me go and try it. I searched, you know, film, theater, drama, music, those kinds of keywords.
Yeah.
Found a lady called Dorothy Getubapala, who was owner of a place called Spielworks Media here in Nairobi, in Kileleshwa. And I messaged her. I was like, hey, this is who I am. This is what I'm doing. I gave her like a brief sort of like what I've been up to. And the funniest part and the biggest blessing was that she actually replied. As big as she was, well, in Mombasa, everyone in Nairobi is huge, right?
Yeah.
As big as she was with her company, producing all these different TV dramas, she replied and she was like, oh, hi, Crystal, da 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 da. The last sentence she wrote was, how can I help you? She didn't go like, sorry, you know, or try this other avenue. She didn't like dismiss me. She was like, how can I help? So from there, fast forward, she brought me, I came to Nairobi, and then she brought me to her her production company, like where they were based. And then she was like, oh, I've got this guy who's keyboardist or pianist, and you can maybe link up with him, write a song, and then if you write a song, if you manage, I'll, you know, get my guys together to like shoot you a very simple music video here on our campus, and you know, we'll put it online and see what happens. And then from there, she introduced me to, or rather, she showed my videos, my Blangal Manenos, and my music video to Carla Mutoko. I went to Carla Mutoko. Mutoko then led to Jeff Koinange. Jeff Koinange led to.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And that's how I started to like build a name for myself and visibility for my work.
Right. Okay. That's I guess what they call serendipity, is it?
Yeah.
Or and just
and,
things.
And just you know, blind faith.
Yeah, literally and literally and figuratively. A question about what money means to you right now, right? You know, like you made reference earlier, you said, yeah, many people would say I'd rather die than go blind. And I think about it now and I'm like, actually, yeah, you know, I mean, I do want to see the things that I spend my money on. And I think that obviously has an implication on what money means to me, you know. So I'm curious, what are the things that matter to you now in terms of what money can do for you and where money is concerned? I mean, do you want to have... and I'm sorry if this sounds like an ignorant question, but do you want to have a lot of money to be able to have like a huge house and, you know, buy a Lamborghini and all of these things? Or did your perceptions and your dreams and your ideas shift a little bit once you lost your vision?
Definitely shifted.
Yeah.
Huge. I think that was actually part of the lesson that I was supposed to learn from losing my eyesight is, what do you focus on? What do you put a lens on in your life? What is really important? Is the house, the Lamborghini, the material things, are they more important than, you know, learning character, learning or improving your personality, you know, emotional health and well-being, things like that? So I lost an appetite for physical things, for sure. Right now I hate shopping. That's one of the things that I feel nasikia kisunzi nikiingia into any kind of shopping mall. I'm just like, I just want to go home.
Yeah.
I don't like shopping. I save a lot more, like a lot more. I live way below my means. Way, way, way. I think my monthly sort of expenditure is including rent.
Yeah.
It's like 50K.
Wow.
Yeah. And that's me living, like, I have everything I need. I'm not struggling at all. And also, I mean, I'm single. I have no children. So that's a factor. But I save a lot more. I can just take my paycheck or whatever I earn from a gig or whatever, and I just say, okay, 80% I'm putting in my savings. And I won't even blink an eye. I'm just like, because I live simply. I still live simply. And I think that is absolutely connected to my eyes.
Yeah.
Because many people who have eyesight are tempted through this.
Yeah.
Yeah, they feel envy through this.
Yeah.
And with this being gone, that cuts off half of my stresses, half of my like mental space and that kind of thing. So I save a lot more. I spend a lot less. I'm not really moved by what is hot, what is not.
Yeah.
If I could still drive my little Toyota IST, which I actually still have in the car park.
Yeah.
I will drive it. The first time I came into Senate, I was still driving my small KBS. It was a KBS Toyota IST.
Right.
Tiny. And colleagues senators were like, Asige, you're going to have to upgrade. Yeah. And I was like, but why? Is that because of you? Do you feel weird and awkward and uncomfortable? Or is it me? Because I'm cool in this car. I'm fine. It's actually you and your perceptions that are skewing what you think an MP should look like, drive in, live in, travel to.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then also I spend more money on experiences than things.
Mm-hmm.
I enjoy going out and spending time with friends, going for walks, like outdoor things, things that don't require a lot of money. And people think, oh, crystals is cheap. And I'm like, no, it's because the experience is worth more. It's more valuable than us going on some like lavish Vipingo Ridge type of I don't know, party, for example, you know, chopping money.
Right.
I'm not really interested in that. So I'm not moved by that. I'm not interested in that. And it's a bit weird at times because I'm like, hey, Crystal, I mean, how cheap can you spend some money? Just spend some money.
Right.
I just regular clothes, regular hair, regular life, you know. Nails are just regular, but it helps.
Yeah.
Maybe it's detrimental. Maybe later when I'm 60, 70, I'll be like, man, I should have treated myself a little bit more, splurged a bit more. But that, it's a combination of how I was brought up and then now my disability put together.
Yeah. Okay. I have a question on that. I wonder, again, not from insensitivity, I'll say that a couple of times, but from curiosity.
Yeah.
I feel like, so like a couple of weeks ago, I had the former CEO of the NSC here, and he was talking about the pressures of his office and, you know, having to drive a specific car or wear, you know, a specific suit or look a specific style because of his position, right? And so I wonder, do you think, because you, I guess, had the privilege of having a life, like you said, a life with vision and one without, do you feel like, if you had made the same decisions you're making now when you had vision, do you think you would have been judged the same way that you are now? Where I feel like, you know, like if you tell me now, I don't care about the IST. I don't care about my clothes. I don't care about that. And I spend 50,000 shillings a month. You know, I'll look and I'll be like, okay, cool. I guess you've gotten my question there. Like before, would you have been given the same... I don't even want to call it grace because it really isn't even grace because it's nobody else's business. Mm. But yeah.
I think people would have judged me more if I were like this with eyesight.
Yeah.
I think they would definitely come harder on me like, oh, you're a grouch, you're a Scrooge, you're, you know, why are you hoarding money? Spend it. Like, let's go out. Sometimes they... Friends and people around me do say that to me, but not as often at all as I see them saying to other people.
Yeah.
Like, let's just spend money. What's 20K? It's just one night. Let's have fun. They don't really say that to me. I think because they're like, this babe, she has enough troubles. Let's not stress her out. Which is good. It's a bit of a cloak, actually. It's actually a bit of a, I'm just like, thank goodness for protection from peer pressures and things like that.
Right.
But certainly I don't think, if I had my eyesight, there would be pressure externally and also internal pressure. Like, I need to keep up. I'm now in Nairobi. I'm now an MP. You know, if I had my eyesight, what are other MPs wearing, doing, going, posting? It would definitely weigh on me. But I'm actually glad. It's quite a blessing, actually. I just thought about that. Thanks.
Yeah. Okay, so now I guess, like, sort of, you know, looking forward, because I'm assuming, I'm not even sure how much do senators make. I'm sure it's somewhere.
On average, MPs make,
it's 500, it's not 500 or 600.
Yeah. About that. Yeah.
So you're at the same.
Yeah, level. And also I have a tax exemption because of my
right.
PWD.
Right.
Actually, good place to go, man. Tax exemption for people with disabilities. Threshold is 150,000.
Right.
So anything I earn,
you're taxed above 150,000.
Correct. Yeah. So okay. From 151,000, I'm taxed. That. Correct. Okay. I'm taxed as everybody else is.
Right.
But that 150,000, I remember the first time I told Senator Sifuna that, he's like, ah, Kumbu, you make more money than me, and I'm a deputy leader in this place.
Yeah.
I'm like, sorry, bro.
Yeah.
Go look for a disability.
Right. Okay.
So, yeah. So that's what we make.
I mean, okay. So now I have to ask you, because you said you spend so little of your money. So what do you do with your money? Like, where, even if you're saying saving, like, where are you putting it? And what is it for?
I have most of my money in a high-yield interest account at my bank. And that's for a year. I can't touch it until after that. But it's at 14.5%.
Yeah.
That's what I'm making interest on.
Yeah.
I also have a property that I've been able to buy out in Kilifi.
Mm-hmm.
So building and working on that is what I'm doing with my money. What else do I like doing with my money? I still spend money traveling.
Mm-hmm.
I do enjoy traveling, like I said, experiences. So now, for example, if there is some sort of a Senate trip, I need to go on duty, I will take like an extra day or two
then
in said place,
right?
Because I can afford it. But also, I spend money on my team, my staff, my parents. I'm taking care of the medicals and the NHIF and things like that, medication, whatever it is that they need. And I also make money as well, because we have a little a flat in Mombasa.
Mm-hmm.
That's somewhere that I also make money from rent.
Mm-hmm.
And I use, at the beginning, before, because I had that flat before I got into parliament.
Mm-hmm.
So I was using the rent from that tenant to now pay installments on, mm-hmm. on that piece of land in Kilifi.
Yeah.
And then I'm trying to buy a house now. So I'm spending, I guess, more on things that are sustainable, more long-lasting,
mm-hmm.
I suppose, rather than, you know, fleeting items and experiences. And
right.
Things. Yeah.
Okay. I'm being chased here, but I have a few things. I have to ask.
How dare you chase?
Yeah. I have to ask, right? first thing, and this again, not insensitivity, curiosity. I want to, and you know, I'm emphasizing.
Ask me anything.
Yeah, I'm emphasizing it also for my people on Twitter, who sometimes like me, sometimes they don't. But my question is, so tell me, you know, they talk about when you lose a sensory, when you lose, you know, the senses, the others are enhanced.
Yeah.
Is that a myth? Is it true? And what's that process actually like? If it is true.
It is true, but not in like a magical woo-woo kind of way.
Like superhero. Yeah.
Not like Batman.
Mm.
It's just more like if you go to the gym and your trainer or yourself, you decide for this next few weeks, I'm going to work on my legs.
Yeah.
Of course, your legs are going to get stronger, right?
Yeah.
Today, I'm going to work on my abs.
Yeah.
Or this month, I'm going to work on XYZ.
Yeah.
That's what it's like.
Okay.
So it's just because I have lost my eyesight, it means that my ears are working harder, my sense of touch is working harder, my sort of like spatial awareness is also working harder. So that's the only reason why, not because there's some sort of magical
like switch that
there's no one went like choo, like you're now better at hearing.
Yeah,
it's only because of practice, and practice is only came out of necessity.
Yeah,
because now I use my ears and my hands to see.
Yeah,
when I walk around somewhere, when I walked in here, I was looking for the chair, touching it, trying to feel. You know, it's very nice material, by the way.
Yeah,
darling.
This is Chico.
It's only high quality and financially correct, guys. Yeah, right? We're financially correct.
Yeah.
So things like that, and my hearing also, I used to see. So when I'm in loud spaces, I literally cannot see.
Yeah.
That's why I don't enjoy going to clubs often, Or being out in environments that are extremely loud, similar to your nephew, mm-hmm, I guess. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But mine is for a little bit of a different reason, because these are my eyes.
Yeah.
So that's the reason why.
Yeah.
But it helps. Nowadays, I do a bit more eavesdropping.
Yeah.
Not on purpose, but yeah. I'm just sitting in a cafe somewhere. Hear, yeah. Just like I hear Njoki saying so and so to Johnny and.
Right.
Yeah. So it's interesting and. Just an experience that's different, but not because of anything else apart from adapting, being agile,
yeah.
Being able to say like, okay, cool, can't do this in one way. Let me look for another way to do it.
Okay. My final question, hopefully the final question.
I'm kidding. I can be here for ages.
It's just that, Shiko's, yeah.
Shiko's
bothering
Shiko's
us.
Shiko's bossy.
Yeah.
Maybe she has a cute voice, but...
wrap us up here quickly. What does a successful, and I want to ask this sort of, two-way, right?
Yeah.
What does a successful life look like for you? And what does a successful life monetarily look like for you? If there's a distinction between a difference between those two, at all, especially because, again, like we've talked about, you don't necessarily spend money on what the average person would really like look at. You don't get envious, you don't get jealous, because you're not able to see those things. Yeah, so I'm just curious what a successful life for you looks like monetarily, like that right now. And
A successful life in general looks like impact. I'm a very high impact, like action-based human being.
Yeah,
I think that also comes from a disability, because when I was told you're going to lose this by this time, I had to get more urgent. There was a sense of urgency that was built inside of me. You know, a battery was put in my back. Have to get this done. Like, okay, I need to learn this, how to do this now. I need to learn how to iron my clothes, cook, clean, etc. Live, basically, before, in quotes, the lights go out type thing. So it created a sense of urgency inside me. So I think that's why I'm such a high-impact human being. I just love having meaning and purpose in everything that I do. I don't just do things for the sake of doing them. I'm just like, okay, what's going to be the end goal here? Which makes me maybe, to some people, like a bit, persist, striving for excellence. Like, yo, give us a break, Crystal. Like, geez, some of us don't move at the speed that you move at.
Yeah.
That kind of feeling. But that's the only reason. It's just because I understand what it's like to not have time to enjoy something fully.
Okay.
Yeah, because it's being taken away. So success looks like impact for me.
Okay.
Changing the world with what I'm doing, changing people's minds, actually,
yeah.
What I'm doing and who I am and what I am putting out into the world, so that stuff can outlive me.
Yeah.
It will... How I make people feel and how I make them feel included and seen and heard and understood, I think will far outlive, a salary,
yeah.
Or, buying something nice for myself. So that's success for me, if that was a clear answer.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was.
No,
but,
yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
And success financially is just being comfortable. I am dreaming of the day when I'm sitting in that Kilifi plot.
Right,
yeah, just
right.
A little bungalow. I don't want to build something crazy.
Yeah.
A little bungalow, Lamu-esque, style housing. A little veranda outside with a pillow, maybe a little dog. That would be dope. Having teas and coffees outside.
Yeah.
My little Bluetooth speaker.
Yeah.
That's for me financially. I'll be happy. And my parents being taken care of. My siblings not having, too much troubles. If I can support them, absolutely I do.
Yeah.
And financially, having investments, of course, that are working for me.
Yeah.
So I don't have to keep working and worrying about money.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's it. And then also, financial inclusion is really important in my finance journey. Mm-hmm. I really want to make banks and financial institutions be more aware of how people with disability interact with money.
Yeah.
So I remember, this is now going back a little bit.
No problem.
And
no problem. Yeah.
I remember there was a time when we were getting the new notes being printed.
Yeah.
And I wrote letters to CBK asking how inclusive are these notes, and I gave them. comparative studies of the UK, Australia, what they do with their notes, America, blah, blah, blah. This is how they have, you know, tactile little bumps.
Yeah.
Some of them have rounded edges on one side so that somebody knows what this is.
Yeah.
You know, very contrasting in colors as well, so that someone with low vision can just put it in front of them close and know what this is, what this
right,
is.
Right.
So I wrote that letter. I wrote a few. And I remember actually being intimidated a little bit.
Yeah.
I was being intimidated by people over there because they were like, you're making too much noise about this. Because some media had, you know, picked up on it, on my conversation about inclusive finance.
Yeah.
So since then, I've been like, okay, why don't banks have ATMs that are inclusive?
Right.
In the UK, in Europe, etc., you will have like a little port where you can stick in earphones,
mm-hmm.
and then automatically the ATM will speak to you as a visually impaired person.
Right.
So you can interact with them, not have to have somebody go like, okay, come and put for me my pin.
Right, right, right.
Why as well do all of these restaurants and different places which give products and services only have touchscreen PDQs?
Right.
Because I can't interact with it as a blind person.
Right.
We need as well, I push for matatus and public service vehicles to now move into smart payments.
Right.
So that I can just get on my M-Pesa and pay because my phone and my devices are suited to me.
Yeah.
I've put on different features
that
I can use them. So financial inclusion is really important. There's a case actually in court right now. It's a visually impaired man who was turned away by a particular bank, I&M Bank, because they were like, oh, you can't open an account with us because we don't know if it will be safe for you to own your own account.
Right.
He's an adult. He's actually a lawyer himself.
Yeah.
So he took them to court because of the discrimination at a different bank. So
because
he was saying, for the paperwork to open an account, can you give me an option to put my fingerprint?
As opposed to.
Exactly. Yeah. Instead of signing, they were like, oh, we don't have a policy around that. You need to get somebody to give up your rights so that they can take care of your account. He's like, no, but finances are very personal.
Yeah.
And they wouldn't have done it to anybody else.
Yeah.
So things like that, society where they are putting barriers in front of you where there shouldn't be any in terms of finance, because that is a right. That is my right, absolutely.
Yeah.
So
inclusion
in finance is really important for people with disabilities to be independent, to have dignity, man.
Yeah.
Be able, I don't want to always have somebody next to me doing everything for me.
Right.
We should get to a place as Kenyans and as Africans whereby you're like, I'm going to give you all that you need, the infrastructure, the knowledge, the training, equipment, assistive technology, so that you, as a disabled person, can live freely as possible.
Right.
So financial success, for me, also includes that.
Okay. Do you have someone that you, like, ultimately trust beyond, I guess, whoever's your aides? I mean, someone who actually knows how much money, for example, like, you have in your account? Is that something that you require to know that, okay, you said your salary has been paid at the end of this month, that they can tell you, yes, actually, it has been paid, and it's X amount, and it's this...
The beauty is, okay, no, I don't, first of
all. Yeah. So if he was to take off with everything
only
as
trust,
he is
only
now,
trust
like,
yourself, people.
Moses, you can be gone.
There's a story of Rosemary Odinga, who went through this thing. She had an aide who she entrusted with her M-Pesa, her phone, and her details, and she got robbed by that person. Just a few years back, you know, she also has a visual impairment.
Yeah. Yeah.
So since then, and it went to the news, I actually had to meet up with her and say, girl, listen, this is how I do mine.
Yeah.
So I'll teach you how to do it. Get a phone, get an Apple, because Apples are, you know, the most forward in terms of technology and security. Do this, train yourself on this. And so because I've been able to get that training when I was back in England, and of course, because I'm more tech sort of
savvy.
Correct. Yeah. I didn't go the Braille way. I went more the tech way because I could see where the world is going.
Yeah.
So because of that, I decided to empower myself by learning how to do my own emails, do my own finances, do my own investments, check on my own... I was going to say shit. Sorry.
Okay.
I trust myself.
Okay. I have a lot more questions and hopefully we'll have you back on again.
Anytime. Chico's.
I'm now, you know, succumbing to Chico's pressure. But my final question
is...
if
you couldn't see, you wouldn't even care. You see, I'm
that's
just here.
True.
I'm living life like exploding.
Yeah.
I'm just like, yeah, whatever. But Chico's giving you the eyes.
Yeah, she's giving me the eyes. Writing all sorts of nasty messages on her phone. Threatening me, you know. Anyway,
no,
my last question for today, because we definitely we have to have her back. Last question is, What one thing that I am taking for granted, me as a person who has vision, that I'm not even aware of,
that you're not aware of, that
you're taking for granted? Yeah, I don't even know that I'm taking it for granted, but you know for sure because of your experience that I am. If you have an answer to that question.
You're taking for granted being seen.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're taking for granted being seen, being considered. You're taking for granted being included, even just in small things. When I was going through my disability and it was first happening, my friends disappeared. They were like, oh, she's not as fun as she used to be. She doesn't go out as much. She's a bit of a burden. We have to take care of her. We have to like hold her arm, pick her up, drop her off, you know, this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so I became less valuable, I guess, in society.
Yeah.
But you, I think, as a non-disabled person, take that for granted. Being seen, being understood, being valued. Yeah, without having to fight twice as hard to get half as far.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I will.
Do you think that? What do you think you take for granted?
It's not me who's extending this interview.
I'd be very interested, though. Sorry, Chico. Just 1 minute, Chico.
It's not me.
Comment section. Tell Chico we love her for these extra minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I can see what you see. You know, I mean, in as far as I can understand you and understand the words that you're saying, I hear what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's one of those things that you probably have to...
You don't know until you know.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Because I can hear what you're saying. Like, I can. And you know, in my mind, I'm like, oh, those are awful friends. Yeah, I wouldn't do the same for, you know, if that happened, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But I honestly don't know, you know. Yeah. I mean, the only person that, like I've mentioned, the only person that I know who has a disability is my nephew. And of course, he's always had it. Always been the same mm-hmm. with him as he always have been. But
mm-hmm.
I don't know if I would have been one of those friends and mm-hmm. been like, oh, yeah. And I don't even know if I would have done it consciously, you know.
Yeah,
so,
a lot of the time it's not conscious. Yeah,
yeah. So I don't know, but I will reflect on it. And when you're here next, because we have to finish this conversation, then
try this. We'll go home.
Yeah.
Try and do a disability simulation. Put a blindfold on.
Yeah.
And then just try and like live and interact just at home in your compound in the
just like with just mm-hmm. like put something on my eyes mm-hmm. and see. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then see how often you get left out of. Oh, let's go for lunch. 20 down to the corner.
Right.
See how much you get left out.
Yeah.
Of conversation, or because you're not really reacting and looking at people in their eyes.
Yeah.
They a lot of times when you look at someone in the eye, you yeah. know that you're talking and yeah. you relate more. But if I can't look in you in the eyes, I am sort of like glossed yeah. over. Try.
I'll let you know how that goes the next time that you're here. Okay, that was. I really, really enjoyed that conversation.
Thank you. So did I.
Yeah,
really
like
fun.
I've learned quite a bit.
I was a bit apprehensive. I was like, what am I going to say?
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
It was
you.
Good.
Thank you. Very.
Okay. Awesome. We'll see you guys on the next episode of Financially Incorrect. Thank you.